From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. This week on Foreign Dispatch, we get a view of the U.S. presidential campaign from France, Iraqi refugees are given a shove in Sweden, and American students get ugly in Italy. But first to Kenya, where people are trying to get back to business after an ugly eruption of ethnic bloodletting. More and more people in Kenya are saying it these days. Things are getting back to normal after months of political and ethnic unrest that killed 1,000 people and displaced hundreds of thousands. But as NPR's Gwen Tompkins reports, life in Kenya these days is a lot like life in any household after a family has had a big fight. Everything may look normal, but nothing is quite the same.
If you want to know how Kenyans are doing nowadays, head straight for the grocery store. There, among the maize meal and the milk and the toilet tissue, you can learn a lot. Moses Kagwema is the manager of a little grocery in downtown Nairobi. He can hardly afford what's on the shelves.
Life in Kenya is very hard, very, very hard, because you cannot afford everything which you need to use, like milk. Most people, they don't take tea with milk. They take plain, because they can't afford milk.
Peace is expensive in Kenya, where political and ethnic fighting in the agricultural heartland of the country destroyed crops and killed livestock. Higher transportation costs are also driving up prices of everyday items. Maybe by the next harvest, maize meal will be more affordable. But corn can't grow any faster than it grows. So until nature takes its course, Kenyans will have to pay up. Trouble is, some people are down to one meal a day.
Nowadays, it gets even 5 to 6 days without selling anything.
Sarah Nyambura runs a little shop for tourists near the grocery store downtown. But tourism, a mainstay of the Kenyan economy, is dead these days. And the last thing most local people want to spend money on is a carved buffalo head. That is, unless the head comes with a side order of fries. Nyambura's income is dropping.
You can hardly sustain yourself. You can hardly take care of costs.
Peter Waweru works at a swank hotel downtown, but he says that even he can't afford all the niceties he used to enjoy. A single young man likes cocktails and pretty girls, but both are almost out of his reach. Waweru is a Kikuyu tribesman. He's now helping to support family members who were burned off their farms in the Rift Valley.
And that calls upon all of us in the family to put in something into a kitty that is supporting these displaced people.
Displaced and anxious. Killings last weekend have left more than a dozen Kenyans dead, mostly in the countryside. Clarice Odhiambo is unsettled. She's a preschool teacher with 7 kids of her own to raise. They used to live north of Nairobi in the Kikuyu-dominated central province of Kenya. But when the unpleasantness erupted after the election, Luos like Odhiambo weren't welcome anymore. She says she felt uncomfortable speaking her own tribal language.
We could not speak Luo. Where? You could not. We used to whisper. Eh? Or to speak Kiswahili.
After a Luo man was beaten to death in front of her daughter, Odhiambo moved the family to a Maasai area, 4 bus rides away. The Ngong Hills were made famous by the book and film Out of Africa. The lover of author Isaac Dinesen is buried here. But Odhiambo couldn't care less about the romance of this place. She just wants the peace. Odhiambo says her children now cower when they hear people speaking Kikuyu. But peace is loud in Kenya and multilingual. Back in Nairobi, at the main market in one of the world's most crowded slums, vendors of every ethnic stripe are piecing together their stalls and selling what they can. This is where you can see a machete, the weapon of choice during the Troubles, do a good thing, like cut lumber to size. Teresia Kamal is a Kikuyu who sells cookies, hard candy, and steel wool in her stall. She doesn't speak English a lot, but she really wanted you all to hear what she had to say, so she said it twice.
May God bless the work of my heart. May God bless the work of my heart. Is it?
The vendors here are quick to tell you their ethnicity. 2 months of ethnic fighting can do that to a population, particularly in the mishmash of Nairobi, where during the height of the tensions, a person's tribe was either a boon or a handicap from one block to the next. But maybe more people here should go to the movies. Before the previews of every movie played in Kenya, the screen fills with an image of a billowing Kenyan flag. The audience stands up and a recording of the national anthem plays. Today, before the afternoon showing of the movie Juno, a young girl bounded out of her seat and snapped to attention. In the dark, she had no ethnicity. She was just a Kenyan. Gwen Tompkins, NPR News, Nairobi.
Now to South Africa, where two teenage sisters from Boston, along with their family and school, have joined forces with an American nonprofit organization to provide laptop computers to underprivileged children. It's part of a global One Laptop Per Child campaign. NPR's Ophebia Quist-Arkton was there when 100 XO computers were delivered to children in Kliptown near Johannesburg.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters.
Thulani Madondo heads the Kliptown Youth Program in one of South Africa's poorer black and mixed-race suburbs. The youth center is hidden behind the railroad tracks up a dirt road. Madondo kicked off the proceedings with the national anthem sung by dozens of cheering schoolchildren and local residents on a bright sunny day. The genesis of the project to provide one laptop each to 100 children in Kliptown goes back a few years. That's after Boston High School students, 17-year-old Hannah Weber and her sister Julia, who's 15, first visited South Africa, made friends in Kliptown and decided they wanted to help. Julia first, then Hannah.
We saw how strong a sense of community they had, and we thought that the laptops would bring in a different sense of community, you know, like one they have online with the mesh network, and we thought it would just be great for them to have this experience.
We have 100 laptops for these kids, and we just can't wait to give it to them, so we're so excited about it.
The ambitious One Laptop Per Child project is the brainchild of Nicholas Negroponte, a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's also a friend of the Weber sisters' father, Larry Weber. The Kliptown youngsters were excited and welcomed their visitors with performances of song and dance. Larry Weber has been instrumental in helping the schoolgirls. Clicking away, taking photos of the event, he said bringing the laptops to Kliptown was a dream come true.
My daughters had come here, Anna and Julia, 2 years ago with a school group from the United States. They were very moved by the community here. And I was explaining to them I had brought home that evening a prototype of what is called the XO computer. And the girls said, gee, Dad, it would be great if those kids in Kliptown could have a chance to use the XO.
Weber said the laptop project has already been introduced to Afghanistan, Haiti, Pakistan, and Rwanda. This is their first foray into South Africa. He said the laptops were specially created for kids to withstand harsh treatment and went through rigorous tests.
First, we had an oven that goes up to 180 degrees, make sure that nothing melts. We dropped them 10 times from 5 feet and see if anything breaks. Nothing broke. We dunked them in a bathtub, and then my favorite was burying them in a few feet of sand and then taking it out and see if they still work. And they still work.
The laptops were meant to cost less than $100 a piece, but are almost double that price, though the project reckons that should drop to below $100 once the machines are mass-produced. Packed with attractive features, including a built-in camera, there were huge smiles as the children lined up for the presentation of the boxed-up little green and white machines.
I'm Nelisiwe Walaza. I'm 17 years old. I'm carrying a laptop, and I'm very happy and excited about it. It's a really great opportunity for us.
What are you going to be doing with your laptop?
Of course, I am going to do games. Yeah, and other things that will be very educational. I mean, education is the key to success, and I think everybody has a right to education, and this is going to help us a lot.
Definitely a success with the Cliptown kids. 100 new EXO laptops and 100 satisfied customers. Ofebia Kwistarkton, NPR News, Cliptown, South Africa.
Every year, tens of thousands of young Americans decide to take a year and study abroad. But in places such as Florence, Italy, binge drinking and rowdy behavior are increasingly causing friction between the students and locals. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli has the story.
It's Sunday night, 10 p.m., and peanut shells already carpet the floor of one of the dozens of pubs in the city center. Six American students are drinking mojitos. Here, 5 euros will buy you 5 drinks. Next day, at a nearby leather goods shop, saleswoman Letizia Biaggi has just cleaned up her sidewalk from the nightly detritus, plastic cups and empty bottles of vodka. In their country, they can't drink so young. Here, even children are offered wine. But Italians go to those pubs only on weekends, Biaggi says, while the Americans are there every night. And then, she adds, they complain about Italian men seducing them. They go around in miniskirts up to here, half undressed. They get drunk. What do they expect? About 7,000 Americans study in Florence in some 40 study abroad programs, and 80% of them are women. American students here were affectionately dubbed the Mud Angels when they helped salvage endangered artworks after the destructive 1966 Florence flood. But lately, the American image has been tarnished. Graziano Cioni, the city councilman in charge of security, remembers when he found about 20 young women plastered drunk, out cold on the street at 4 a.m. What sticks out about the Americans, he says, is that so many are well-heeled young women, often seen vomiting on the side of the cobblestone streets. Cioni says binge drinking is starting to be a problem also with Italians, and he stresses it affects only 10% of the entire American student population here.
But Americans do stick together. It is hard to see American students hanging out with Italian students. They are a clique, a close community.
You have this group of students who come, and they have great passion and enthusiasm.
Barry Hochwald lives and teaches in Florence.
And then they don't quite know what to do when they get here or where to go. The city is not open to them outside of their classrooms. It's a difficult city to get to know and to connect to.
Most of the students have never been out of their state before, and some of them turn the entire school semester into one long spring break. Italian bar owners have tapped into the big student market with special offers like Ladies' Night, while tour operators organize night-long pub crawls. Barry Hochwald.
Number one market in Florence is tourism, and the second is the American college student. And that's why both tourism and the American college student own Centro right now. They are the dominant factors in this historic center of the city. Florentines don't live here. It doesn't belong to them anymore, and they're resentful of that. And they should be.
As an alternative to pub crawls, Hochwald founded a program she calls Creative Campus at the Florence International Theater. The theme of the latest student-written performance was about stereotypes, like the American party girl and the Italian Latin lover.
All right, so whenever you're ready.
At a rehearsal, New Yorker Antonella Lentini and a young Florentine man were reciting their parts on stage.
In fact, many female students who study abroad fantasize of meeting a hot Italian man. And I can't help but wonder, is it our own fantasy that builds the chauvinism and stigmatism that we receive from some Italian men?
Ciao, bella! Ciao, baby!
Lentini says her scene was inspired by what she saw the first week she was in Florence.
After one of the experiences of seeing this American girl at Astor Cafe basically strip on the bar and, like, my friends and I feel really embarrassed to be here and be American and kind of want to hide that we were American.
Engia Beale of North Carolina says it took a while to get used to Italian men ogling her on the street, but she admits the Italian language can be seductive.
In America, you're not going to have, you have guys like, hey, girl, you know, but for some reason, a romantic language like Italian, it sounds a little bit better than hey, girl, what's up, you know. They're acting like just like American guys, but the language makes it more entertaining, I think. For the female.
Drinking until the wee hours of the morning leaves many young women in Florence off guard and more vulnerable to sexual assault or even rape.
City authorities have begun to crack down. They've imposed a 1 a.m. ban on serving alcohol in pubs. They've put closed-circuit TV cameras throughout the city center. And they're working more closely with administrators of study abroad programs to provide alternative activities for young students. Something like this performance at the Florence International Theater, where Jordan Classic of Nebraska plays tribute to Italian popular music. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News.
Away from the maddening crowds, we can sing in the glow of a star that I know of.
Coming up, Sweden tries to reverse the tide of Iraqi refugees.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. Sweden has taken in more than 20,000 Iraqi refugees since the start of the Iraq War. That's more than any other country outside the Middle East. But now the Swedish government says there is no internal armed conflict in Iraq, and it has started sending Iraqi refugees back home against their will. Jerome Sokolovsky reports.
Refugees are learning Swedish in the town of Flen, about an hour and a half from Stockholm. Where does Mohammed come from, the teacher asks. From Turkey, the students reply in Swedish, much to their teacher's delight. The class is held inside an old church. Through the windows, you can see the red wooden houses typical of the Swedish countryside. Inside, the classroom is filled with Iraqis, Afghans, Kurds, Somalis, and others from the world's war zones. They're all hoping to get political asylum in Sweden. Ali Qasim is from Bakuba in Iraq's Diyala province. Last December, on the eve of the Muslim Feast of the Sacrifice, he says, a car bomb exploded outside his house and one of his sons was hit by shrapnel.
This is the boy. He's showing the picture of the little boy who got hurt. You know, this is 7 years old.
Ali Qasim puts his head in his hands. He can't control his grief.
He said, what have you done, this little child, 7 years old, this happened to him.
The boy survived thanks to the help of American military doctors. But he and the rest of Qasim's family are still in Iraq. The father hopes Sweden will accept them all. A few years ago, their chances would have been pretty good. But last October, the Migration Appeals Court ruled that there's, quote, no internal armed conflict in Iraq. And in recent months, nearly three-quarters of Iraqi asylum requests have been rejected. Mikael Fred of Sweden's Migration Board says he understands why there was outrage over the ruling.
You have different views, of course. But in this case, the Immigration Court of Appeal had to use the Swedish rules connected with this in our legislation.
But critics say those rules refer to conventional conflicts with rival armies holding territory, not insurgencies like the one in Iraq. They say Sweden's refugee policy is becoming tougher. Clara Steinberg, who runs the language school in Flen, says she doesn't always agree with the migration court's decisions. But she concedes that the country has become overwhelmed by refugees.
There are no places for people to stay. They are staying in camping houses, at hotel, at youth hostels. There are so many people coming in one time that it's hard for the administration to deal with it.
The Swedish government also faces political pressures. Many people are complaining that there are too many foreigners, especially in towns like Flen, where just a few decades ago, almost everyone had fair hair and blue eyes. But even in this Scandinavian nation, with its reputation as a haven for refugees, anti-immigrant sentiment is growing, like elsewhere in Europe. There are few native Swedes at this trendy cafe in Stockholm. At one table, two men talk in Arabic. At another, an Iranian woman and her Chilean friend coo over a baby. At the next table is Michael Olsen, a reporter for Swedish Public Radio. He says the migration court's decision is a smokescreen for a government policy shift.
The Swedish government has for 2 years or 3 years been pounding on other countries within the EU to follow the Geneva Convention, to show some solidarity, and they haven't listened. So there has, of course, been a very pragmatic decision-making within the Swedish government. Since no one else is doing their duty, we can't do it either.
In February, Sweden signed a deal with the Baghdad government to start sending refugees back to Iraq against their will. The first deportation took place on March 11th. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolovsky in Stockholm.
Lastly, we go to France, where there has been unprecedented interest in the U.S. presidential race. Perhaps it's because many in France have stopped liking their own president. Nicolas Sarkozy's ratings are in the basement. Or perhaps it's because France itself nearly got its own first woman president. Whatever the reason, freedom fries are forgiven. The French can't get enough of the American presidential race, as Eleanor Beardsley reports from Paris.
For the last 6 months, 23-year-old journalism student Pierrick Laurent has been keeping a daily blog on the American presidential election.
Most people in France would be very happy to see either a woman or a black president.
Laurent says traffic to his website has shot up phenomenally since the primary season began in January because people are fascinated by the candidates, especially the two Democrats.
Maybe it's just a stereotype, but I think French people still think that's part of the American dream, like, this kind of thing can happen in America, and it's great.
French television has covered every primary. The popular daily newspaper Le Parisien even conducted a national opinion poll. When it was published back on Super Tuesday, it showed Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton nearly neck and neck. Robert Arajol, owner of a Paris video store, is a Hillary Clinton supporter. He says Clinton is much more impressive than last year's French female presidential contender, Ségolène Royal.
Hillary Clinton represents the best in America. She's dynamic, radiant, she knows what she's talking about, and she makes you believe in things. If we'd have had her against Nicolas Sarkozy, she would have beaten him.
But now it looks increasingly like Arajol is in the minority. France seems to be falling in love with Barack Obama. There is a fascination in France for a black man who has made it this far in American society. His story has some people from the suburban housing projects in France, where French racial integration has largely failed, asking, "Where is our Barack Obama?" At a cafe table looking out on a drizzly Paris morning, Samuel Sauvite plans the activities of his support committee for Barack Obama. Sauvite says if Obama is elected, it will improve America's image throughout the world.
It will change the way of seeing the United States. You are not just an hostile country, but you are a multicultural country, very open-minded, modern, and really more than that other country.
Newspaper editorials say much of the enthusiasm for the Democrats is a response to 8 years of an unpopular Bush administration. There's a desire here for a new relationship with America, and for many French people, that means a new party in the White House. The French don't understand the GOP, says Pierre Toulec as he sips his beer at an outdoor cafe on the Champs-Élysées. His group, the Association of Friends of Republicans, is trying to change that. Toulec supports the Iraq war and says only a President John McCain can protect the West from the Islamist threat.
I like John McCain because he will be tough on the war on terror. I think it's important to show all around the world that there is people really wanting John McCain to be the next American president, because he's not only the American president, he's the leader of the free world.
While there was some TV coverage of McCain's visit last week with President Sarkozy, it was Obama's speech on racism that dominated the nation's attention, leaving some pundits to observe that France was now in the grip of Obama mania. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Dee Dee Skanky.